Tonight, we want to talk about the relationship between Malcolm X and this remarkable, this extraordinary life to the challenges that confront African Americans in the 21st century. On January the 20th, 1999, nearly 34 years after the public assassination of Malcolm X at the Audubon Ballroom, a very different kind of public gathering focusing on the black leader was held at Harlem's historic Apollo Theater. Attended by over 1,500 people, the crowd prominently included celebrities, entertainers, and political leaders such as Ossie Davis, Ruby Dee, Harry Belafonte, and millionaire Harlem entrepreneur and Malcolm X's former attorney, Percy Sutton. The purpose of the occasion was to mark the unveiling of the United States Postal Service's newest release in its Black Heritage stamp series. The issuance of a postage stamp bearing the likeness of Malcolm X or El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz. Congressman Shaka Fatah, the ranking Democrat on the House of Representatives Postal Subcommittee, remarked to the gathering, quote, "There is no more appropriate honor than this stamp because Malcolm X sent all of us a message through his life and his life's work," unquote. For Fatah, Malcolm X's, quote, "thoughts, his ideas, his conviction, and his courage provide an inspiration even now to new generations to come." No one in the audience could ignore the rich irony of such an event. One of America's sharpest and most unrelenting social critics was now being honored by that same government that had carried out illegal harassment and surveillance against him. Ossie Davis, who understood the significance of the moment better than nearly anyone else, quipped, quote, "We in this community look upon this commemorative stamp, finally, as America's stamp of approval," unquote. The Malcolm X stamp was the 22nd release in the Black Heritage series, which had already featured other prominent figures from Black American history, including Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Mary McLeod Bethune, and W.E.B. Du Bois. The U.S. Postage Service also released a brief statement accompanying the stamp's issuance, noting that the retouched photographic image of Malcolm X had been taken by an associate press photographer at a press conference held in New York City on May the 21st, 1964. The statements explained that soon after this photograph had been taken, that Malcolm X, quote, "later broke away from the organization," referring to the Nation of Islam, the NOI, "disavowed his earlier separatist preaching and supported a more integrationist solution to racial problems," unquote. This was the Postal Service. What one could generously say about this curious statement was that it was at best a product of poor scholarship. The photograph actually had been taken during an interview in Cairo, Egypt, on July 14th, 1964. Malcolm had publicly broken with the NOI on March the 8th, 1964, 2 months earlier than the official statement suggested. Even more problematic was the unsupported and erroneous assertion that Malcolm had become a proponent of, quote, "an integrationist solution to racial problems," unquote. But none of these errors of fact and ideological distortions seemingly bothered those who celebrated the Malcolm X postage stamp as a triumph of Malcolm X's politics. So the question you have to encounter, class, is this a triumph of Malcolm X's politics? It is instructive to note that the United States was actually the second nation to issue a Malcolm X postage stamp. The first nation was the government of Iran under Ayatollah Khomeini in 1984. 15 years earlier. So for more than 1 billion Muslims throughout the world, the lessons to be drawn from the life of El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz are somewhat different than those offered by the U.S. Postal Service. Indeed, in the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 attack and subsequent U.S. military invasion of Afghanistan, a different dimension of Malcolm X's life story came to public attention. John Walker Lind, a white 21-year-old student from an affluent Marin County, California suburban home, was seized in Afghanistan's underground cave by the U.S. military forces. Lin was hiding out with 86 Taliban fighters. Lin, a convert to a fundamentalist version of Islam, had traveled to Afghanistan in the hope that he could, quote, as he put it, quote, help to create a true Islamic state, unquote. What had led John Walker Lin to join forces with Al-Qaeda and the group's shielding terrorist Osama bin Laden? Lin's parents suggested to the media that their son's interest in Islam, quote, may have been sparked by the autobiography of Malcolm X, which he read when he was only 16 years old. The Lin case illustrates that Malcolm X, nearly four decades after his assassination, still has the capacity to inspire sharply different points of view, sharply different perspectives, from the mountains of Afghanistan in Iran to the streets of Harlem. Although Malcolm X is today one of the most popular and celebrated figures in African American history, it is also a curious fact that there exists to date no serious biographical study by a professional historian of the subject. What is striking, therefore, when one surveys the entire body of historical and literary interpretive material on Malcolm X since 1965 is its overwhelmingly superficial character. Why are there so few serious studies of the real, quote-unquote, real Malcolm? Well, the primary reason is that no comprehensive collection of Malcolm X's correspondence, his writings, and accurately transcribed text of his many public speeches and sermons exists. Unlike the collected papers of black leader Booker T. Washington in the Library of Congress, the Washington papers in the Library of Congress comprise about 1,077 separate boxes, linear feet of materials. It's a massive collection. It's stored at the Library of Congress in Washington. Malcolm's materials are, by contrast, scattered in dozens of institutions and libraries all over the United States. There are also several hundred professional and informal collectors of Malcolm X memorabilia who own rare personal items, audio tape recordings of speeches, even pieces of the Audubon Ballroom stage and podium where he was murdered in 1965. Beginning in 2001, the Malcolm X Project here at Columbia has tracked down the location of many of these items and has begun to construct an archive based on the day-to-day calendar of significant details and events during Malcolm's life. The process has been difficult and it's been time-consuming, but it's been extremely rewarding in what we've learned about Malcolm X. The larger questions posed by the life of Malcolm are related to the evolution or making of modern urban black America. And only from that vantage point can we understand the long-term significance of Malcolm X. Dr. King was in many ways the personification of the black South and its struggle to overcome the burden of Jim Crow segregation. Though based in urban Atlanta, Martin, nevertheless, is really identified, if one looks at the evolution of the civil rights movement, with the rural Black Belt South. the campaigns for desegregation that occurred in Albany, Georgia, in Selma, Alabama, in Montgomery, Alabama. This is the Black Belt. Malcolm, on the other hand, is in many ways the kind of personification of the emergence of the ghetto and the rise of an urban-based black culture in the 20th century. And I would argue that more than any single person from the period roughly 1945 to 1975, the voice that best expresses and articulates black urban culture is Malcolm X. In 1920, about 80% of all African Americans lived in the South, and an equal percentage lived in rural communities. By 1970, 81% of all African Americans lived in cities as a consequence of the Great Migration. In just a brief 20-year period between 1910 to 1930, the number of blacks living in New York City alone soared from 91,000 to 327,000. In Chicago, the leap was even more spectacular, from 44,000 to 233,000. In Detroit, an increase was even larger, from 5,700 blacks who lived in Detroit in 1910 to 120,000 by 1930. Now, telling the complex life story of how Malcolm Little, born in Omaha, Nebraska, emerged as the streetwise hustler Detroit Red in Harlem and Roxbury in the early and mid-1940s, and subsequently evolved into the prominent black nationalist orator and activist Malcolm X 15 years later, requires us to link this biographical journey to the narrative of how urban black America also came into existence in parallel fashion at the same time. Malcolm's narrative from rural Omaha, Nebraska, to Detroit Red, to Roxbury, to Harlem, and his evolution as a political figure is also the evolution, it's the political narrative of black urban America coming to growth at the same time. Malcolm's rise to popularity in the 1950s and 60s and the exponential growth of the Nation of Islam from roughly 400 members in 1946 to 100,000 members in 1960 was the result of a sea change in black social and political consciousness. This is one of the questions that we've been pursuing throughout the class. What explains the massive growth of the NOI? The growth of the NOI comes about because of the transformation of black America and how black America saw itself. The consciousness of the modern urban ghetto brought about a parallel racial universe for African Americans in the North. Millions had managed to escape the South with its Jim Crow segregation, its lynching, its vigilante violence, and what? Only then to encounter a more subtle, sophisticated discrimination in the urban North. The vast majority of Northern blacks throughout the 1930s, 40s, and 50s were forced to send their children to unequal segregated urban schools. They were still excluded through racial covenants from purchasing homes in predominantly white neighborhoods. They were largely excluded from most professional and managerial occupations up through the 1960s. Politically, they could exercise their voting rights, but they were largely denied equitable political representation. In fact, go back to 1964. In 1964, there were a total of only 104 black elected officials throughout the entire country. The total number of blacks in Congress was 5. The number of mayors, black elected mayors in the U.S. in 1964 was 0. So that when Malcolm rails against the white political establishment, he is not being racist by describing it as white, because literally, almost completely, It is as white as the apartheid system in South Africa that existed at the same time. That there is no real evidence prior to the passage of the Voting Rights Act that African Americans in the North would have decent or equitable treatment or access to decision making. That in 1964, the Democratic National Convention, only 3% of the delegates are African Americans, even though blacks provided the balance of power and elected Kennedy president in 1960. So despite the reality of integration, there was no integration. So Malcolm's argument for a separatist approach, while seeming extreme in the context of what Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement is saying, actually is reflective of the material conditions under which most urban blacks live. And so it is not an extreme statement to focus on the actual material content of how people live their lives and try to fashion a strategy that addresses that. Now, in this racially repressive environment, African Americans migrated to the Northeast and the Midwest, sought to create advocacy organizations that would protect their rights and preserve their sense of community. In general, these black organizations evolved along three basic lines of development, I argue in my own work. Some advocated strategies favoring the complete and total dismantling of all laws that kept blacks separate from whites. That is, they favored an approach called colorblind or integration, that Negro Americans must receive the same rights and access to public accommodations that white Americans had. This is an integrationist approach. A second approach focused on the character of the black community as a working class community and advocated black participation in unions and in working class organizations that would empower and increase blacks' earning power and that would transform the black community through access to jobs that could support living wages and support families. And so many blacks organized and fought through the union movement. This was also a strategy that was favored by the political or the ideological left, the Communist Party, and other activists on the radical left. Third approach was the approach taken by the black nationalists. As black sharecroppers and farm workers migrated into cities, they were quickly assimilated into the lowest levels of the urban working class. Blacks were largely excluded from joining whites-only craft unions, so they created their own benevolent associations so that it became clear, despite the left strategy, that because of exclusion and discrimination, then the black nationalist approach was to build capacity within your community, to build institutions that provided goods and services that addressed the needs of the African American community, to create the kinds of positive role models for black boys and girls that allowed for the enhancement of the imagination within the African American community, not to see oneself as a victim, but rather as an actor in the making, in the construction of a new history. So the Nation of Islam's approach was one that had deep historical roots and common sense given the context of the African American community. I think that black nationalism, the reason that Malcolm resonated so profoundly with black urban America is that not only were the material conditions of black urban America structured in through a kind of racialized parallel universe where we speak the same language, we're theoretically with white Americans, we theoretically are governed by the same sets of laws, but we encounter reality in fundamentally different ways. And so the separatist approach was not something that was extremist. It simply spoke to the structural realities of black life. Just walk down Cottage Grove or 125th Street, or walk down Crenshaw Boulevard in L.A. I mean, it just spoke to the structural segregation that existed. Malcolm built on the political culture of black nationalism and the common sense that it made. He also built on Booker T. Washington, and as well as, of course, Elijah Muhammad. Where Malcolm, his innovation really comes, I think, in several ways. That, and this is where I think the missing chapters of the autobiography are critical. And I really didn't understand this until after going through and teaching this class. When Malcolm writes the autobiography, there are three chapters where he lays out a program, a black nationalist program, that actually speaks to 20 million African Americans. And so he attempts to take the Nation of Islam, a black separatist organization, and create a framework for a broad united front that would include the totality of black America. He's envisioning a united front that unites the entire spectrum of the black community around the practical things of daily life that you, Tongo, allude to. You know, how do people eat? How do they work? Structures for educating children, healthcare, education, all these things are actually spoken to in a very detailed program. Malcolm was the first to do that. I think the second thing that he does is understand what he called the Bandung spirit. He identified with the Third World Non-Aligned Movement. He drew the analogy of a domestic colony and domestic colonialism with Third World colonialism. Now, other people had done this before, but not in the form of a dynamic program that would then take black America and then go to the United Nations. Now, other people had done this before. William Patterson in 1947-48, along with Paul Robeson and Du Bois, were going to go to the United Nations, charging the U.S. with genocide against African Americans. But Malcolm, that program had been suppressed during the Cold War. Malcolm elevated it again, but gave it a black nationalist twist. How would we judge the long-term significance of Malcolm X in both the political culture of black America and within the politics of race in the United States for the 21st century? How is Malcolm relevant to today? Well, in the international context, I think that Malcolm would be disturbed by the transnational growth of what scholars now refer to as globalization, or more specifically as it relates to Africa and the Third World, what some scholars call now global apartheid or global apartheid. Western democratic states increasingly have constructed authoritarian and elitist barriers to popular participation and decision-making, targeting largely racial minorities and immigrants. Privatization in such societies organized around racial hierarchies has become in many ways a new form of racialization. The signs reading white and colored have been taken down, yet in a kind of colorblind world, there is nevertheless the discrimination that is based on the absence of resources and material wealth. In the United States, Malcolm would probably note today, more than 30% of African Americans currently employed are working in the public sector. Any significant cut in government and in government expenditure actually undermines in a disproportionate way African American workers. The ultimate goal of any anti-racist movement should be the delegitimation and destruction of all forms of hierarchies based on race. Social scientists today agree that race is socially constructed. It has no biological or genetic validity. embedded in the very concept of race and racial thinking is the concept of hierarchy and intolerance and discrimination. I think that Malcolm X, if he were here today, would agree with that. But the question is then, how would Malcolm go about dismantling these hierarchies of discrimination? Malcolm today would undoubtedly argue that the black freedom movement in the United States has to reorient itself in a period of globalization and transnational corporations toward an anti-racist politics being waged throughout the entire globe. Malcolm, toward the end of his life, argued that throughout his life he had believed that the struggle was between black versus white. At the end of his life, he said, "Now I believe that I was wrong, that the struggle truly is between the haves versus the have-nots." I think if Malcolm were here today, he would build on that perception, and he would argue that in a period of globalization, that a kind of globalization from below is needed, a globalization that unites Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, that would have a politics and a language that talks about a new world order from the vantage point of the vast majority of the people of the planet. That's the kind of discourse that Malcolm would be talking about. I think that Malcolm would argue that black Americans living in a racist society had to constantly struggle to free themselves from the cultural domination and psychological dependency that is imposed by racism. In other words, in order to believe in one's own capacity to create social change, you have to break from the psychological dependency that the system imposes upon one. The quest for power, Malcolm believed, begins first and foremost in one's mind. You cannot become a free person unless you begin to think of yourself as a free person. Indeed, this was Malcolm's greatest insight and his greatest gift, I believe, to future generations of African Americans and other people of color throughout the world. He changed the way that black people thought about themselves. It's a simple statement, but I believe it's true. More than any other figure, Malcolm changed how black people saw themselves. Malcolm attempted as a teacher to move African Americans from being the footnotes in someone else's history to becoming the key actors in the making of their own history. Instead of singing someone else's song, they discover the beauty of their own voices. For Malcolm, black reparations, for example, represented a way for black people to challenge and subvert the master narrative that white America had imposed on them and to testify to the truth of their own history. So Malcolm constantly chided and criticized African Americans. He criticized their leaders and their actions, but for a larger social purpose. Oppressed people live their lives in a kind of state-imposed traumatic existence that Malcolm, they are in effect presented to the world by racism as being people outside of history. What Malcolm attempted to do was to bring black people back to their own history and to become not people acted upon, but the makers of their own history. In the words of Edward Said, the task of the radical intellectual is to create in a colonial society, is to create new racial subjects. Perhaps the greatest testimony to Malcolm's greatness is that he created new racial subjects, and that in many real ways, the lessons of Malcolm's life and the ideals that he fought for and died for constantly create new racial subjects even today.